All right. So this evening we're going to pick up in Genesis 22. It has been some time in this series. We did the walkthrough last week to bring us back up to speed, and we're going to pick up in Genesis 22, and Lord willing, get down through verse 19. So for the bulk of Genesis 22, the account of Abraham's offering of his son Isaac. So let's read here a bit, beginning in verse 1. Now it came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, "Abraham," and he said, "Here I am." And he said, "Take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you." So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son. And he split wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. And Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go yonder, and we will worship and return to you." And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. And Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." And he said, "Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" And Abraham said, "God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." So the two of them walked on together. Then they came to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built the altar there, and arranged the wood, and bound his son Isaac, and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham," and he said, "Here I am." And he said, "Do not stretch out your hands against the lad and do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Then Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his thorns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place, "The Lord will provide." As it is said to this day, "In the mount of the Lord it will be provided." Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and you have not withheld your son, your only son. Indeed, I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba. And Abraham lived at Beersheba. So this particular event occurs at least as far as I can tell, some unspecified time later. There are some hints in the text as to how old Isaac is in this account. We'll see later as we get to verses, verse 6, Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on on Isaac, his son. We see that Isaac is clearly not an infant here, right? So Isaac is an older lad, as it were, and some of the commentators would say that he's even into his teens at this time. And so he's young, but not so young. And it says clearly in verse 1 that God calls to Abraham in order to test him. And there's a sense in which the connotation here of the language is that he's trying Abraham, or even proving out Abraham, proving out Abraham's faith. And that's what's happening here. God is testing or trying or proving Abraham. And the test, of course, appears in verse 2, God says to Abraham, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah. And I note here that in verse 2 and in verse 12 and then again in verse 16, what is the common phrase in these three verses? Verse 16, he refers to Isaac in a very, your son, your only son, right? And so, we've talked about it here before, when we see repetition in the Bible, right? We've talked about this implies emphasis, right? So the biblical writers didn't have things like underline and bold and italics. And so in the Hebrew idiom, repetition is a form of emphasis. Jesus says, truly, truly, I say unto you, for example, right? So we have to perk up in these things. In this particular text, Moses writes down for us this phrase, your son, your only son, three times in the span of 15 verses, right? So, and this is significant for multiple reasons. So, first of all, is Isaac Abraham's only son? No. That's right. Abraham's other son is Ishmael. That's right. And yet, and this is God speaking. It's God speaking in all three of these cases. Verse 2, verse 12, verse 16. God himself, the angel of the Lord, more accurately, the angel of the Lord, referring to Isaac as Abraham's son, his only son. All right? Why is that?
He's the only son of promise.
He's the only son of the promise. Right? You remember back, as we've been studying through Genesis, God makes a promise to Abraham that he would have an heir from his own body. Then we spent a lot of time talking about Hagar and Ishmael and how Sarai and Abram, at the time, take the fulfillment of that promise of God into their own hands, right? They attempt to fulfill that promise from God by their own power. We spent a lot of time on this. We were in Galatians 4, if you remember, right? And Abraham does indeed bear a son of his own loins, but not with Sarah, rather with Hagar, the Egyptian servant, and therefore not according to the promise. So in God's eyes, Isaac, the son of the promise, the unique only son of the promise, is Abraham's only son, only relevant son to the storyline of biblical redemptive history. And so I was thinking about this today, and how many sons, so if we read through the New Testament, how many sons does God have? If we just read through the New Testament, how many? So the answer, for those of you who are listening via podcast, is one. I submit to you 1 John 3:1. See how great a love the Father has bestowed upon us that we should be called the sons of God. God has redeemed for himself, according to Revelation 5, verse 9, peoples, myriads upon myriads of peoples whom he has ransomed by the blood of Jesus Christ from every tribe, language, people, and nation. There is a sense in which God has many adopted sons. And yet, there is also a sense in which it is very clear from the New Testament that God has only one unique Son. John chapter 3, verse 16. For God so loved the world that he gave his, some translations read, one and only Son. Right? And I have to believe that John has Genesis 22 in his mind. All right. So there's a uniqueness. Although Abraham has more than one son, and actually we will get in a couple of chapters, Abraham will have more offspring later. Right? Abraham doesn't only have one son, but he also, there is a sense in which he only has one unique son of promise who is relevant to the biblical redemptive story, who the promises that God made to Abraham will pass then to Isaac, to Jacob. In that sense, Isaac is unique and is Abraham's only son. Okay? And again, I emphasize the point and sort of expand on the point because the text emphasizes that point in that it is said by God to Abraham three times in 15 verses. All right? Also in verse 2, perhaps you all know this, but where are they headed? Pardon? Yeah, Mount Moriah. They're headed to the land of Moriah. Does anybody know what Moriah is or where Moriah is? Moriah is the exact site of the temple in Jerusalem. Okay? So David comes along, Solomon comes along, 1200-ish, it's somewhere between 1200 and...
2 Chronicles, chapter 3.
Yeah, 2 Chronicles, chapter 3. I'm talking about the time frames, like 1200, somewhere between 12 and 10, 1200 and 1000 BC, somewhere in there. Fair?
Thank
you. Okay. Abraham, this interaction between God and Abraham is coming far before that, and yet, God is sending Abraham with his only son to be sacrificed on the site of the temple in Jerusalem. And you can see that, as Pastor Mike said, in 2 Chronicles 3. I have that right? Did you say 2? Yes, 2 Chronicles chapter 3, verse 1, if you'd like to follow up on that. That is the site of the temple as built by Solomon. All right, so Abraham and Isaac off to make a sacrifice at the site of the temple in Jerusalem. And so what you should be starting to see very clearly in Genesis 22, here are the echoes of the New Testament. Right? The typologies in Genesis 22 could not be clearer. So let's continue on. Verse 3, Abraham rises early in the morning. Apparently, Abraham is rising early in the morning commonly. We've seen that previously. For example, 21 verse 14. I happen to think, again, I think as I mentioned last time when we were in chapter 21, Abraham rose early in the morning because I don't know how would you feel if God had commanded you to take this son whom you loved. Right? That's what it says in verse 2. Take your son, your only son whom you love, and kill him. My guess is Abraham didn't sleep very well. So he wakes up early in the morning. And, of course, he saddles his donkey, takes the young man, Isaac, his son, and he travels 3 days, the 3-day journey, to Moriah. And he sees it in the distance, verse 4. He tells the young men to stay behind, stay here with the donkey, and he and Isaac then are off to worship, verse 5, and then return back to you. He says, we will return to you. Very interesting. And in verse 6, again, I mean, the imagery should be clear to you. Your cross-reference, if you have a cross-reference, should be also very clear. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son. Your cross-reference most likely points you to John chapter 19, verse 17. John 19, verse 17. which reads, so verse 16, so he then delivered him. Pilate then delivered Jesus to be crucified. Verse 17, they took Jesus therefore and he went out bearing his own cross to the place called the place of a skull, which in Hebrew is called Golgotha. All right. So Isaac, Abraham's son, his only son whom he loves, now has wood placed upon him to be carried to the site of the sacrifice. Abraham carries the fire and the knife, and the two of them walked on together. At verse 7, at some point, Isaac becomes confused, right? At least curious, and calls out to his father, and Abraham responds, verse 7, and he says, behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And here in verse 8, again, remember, Moses is writing this 1,500 plus years before the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Right? So we imagine Jesus in Luke 24. He's walking after the resurrection. He's walking along the road to Emmaus. He comes upon the two disciples. And it says that beginning with Moses and the prophets, he explained to them that all of those things that were written in Moses and the prophets were actually about him. Right? And I don't know where he went. It's not clear where he went in Moses and the prophets. But look at verse 8, 22 verse 8. Abraham says to his son Isaac, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So, what is this evidence of? It's evidence of a few. It's evidence of God's faithfulness. It's evidence of God's own work of redemption, as we saw way back in Genesis chapter 3. If you remember, after Adam and Eve had sinned, they took fig leaves, they sewed for themselves loincloths. We talked at that time about this is what all religions are. This is man's own works-based attempt to cover his own shame and sin. God comes in, and after the curses, God himself sacrifices an animal and makes loincloths for Adam and Eve out of the skins of the animal that had been killed. God himself provided the only adequate sacrifice and covering for sin. That was the beginning of the biblical redemptive history, Genesis 3:15, with the proto-evangel and God covering Adam and Eve. And here we have it again, a prophecy out of the mouth of Abraham wherein he responds to his son, most likely not knowing exactly what he was saying, and says that God will provide for himself a lamb for the burnt offering. And again, on this side of the cross, we look back at this and go, man, is this clear? It's clear. So clear what God has been doing all along. Evidence of Abraham's faith. Evidence of Abraham's faith. God's faithfulness, God's own work of redemption, and Abraham's faith. Right? This story has become relatively commonplace to us. I think if we were raised in a church, we've heard this story so many times. But you know, just try to work yourself into this story. Imagine that you're Abraham. And what kind of thoughts and emotions must be going through your mind on a 3-day journey? Could you imagine walking 3 days on the way to sacrificing the son whom you love? Right? I mean, when I have something hard to do, I just kind of want to get it done, right? It was Tom Petty said, waiting is the hardest part. The waiting is the hardest part, right? It's that place where your mind's playing tricks on you and you've got this battle with anxiety and all. And I mean, just imagine, for tonight, put yourself into Abraham's shoes. Walking 3 days. And yet, here as they're approaching the place of the sacrifice which God had shown to him, he still has faith. Not knowing what it means, but he's got it. We were studying Peter in Sunday school, remember? And there was, Peter says, I don't remember the exact citation, but Peter says that the prophets were writing these things for us, and they didn't even know what they were writing sometimes. Right? I think this is evident. This is a place where Abraham is speaking, and he doesn't even know what he's saying. And I also think of the Caiaphas in the New Testament, who's speaking a prophecy, the high priest in Jesus' day. He's speaking a prophecy, and he doesn't even know he's prophesying the redemptive work of Christ. Verse 9. Abraham and Isaac come to the place which God had told him. Abraham built the altar there. And again, let's get into Abraham's shoes now, his mind, his heart. He arranges the wood. He binds his son Isaac. And he lays him on the altar on the top of the wood. John 18, verse 12. So the Roman cohort and the commander and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. How about Isaac here? This text doesn't speak actually too much about Isaac, except that he's apparently a willing participant. Whatever I would say at this point would be pure speculation, since the text doesn't speak to it. So, is this a commentary on Isaac's faith? I don't know. A commentary on Isaac's relationship with his father Abraham? I don't know. Comment. Nonetheless, the text is very clear here that Isaac is a willing participant. And again, if I were, what's the type here in verse 9? The type is, again, obviously Jesus Christ. John chapter 10, I lay down my life for the sheep. No one takes it from me. I give it up of my own accord. Right? And so when we think about Isaac's willingness to go through with this sacrifice, John 10 ought to be echoing in our minds. Jesus' willingness to go to the cross. So many bad analogies are spoken from the pulpit in an attempt to try and help people to understand the atoning work of Jesus Christ. And they're, most of them are really, really, really bad. And have to do, in some sense, I have one particular one in my mind that I'm not going to speak here tonight, but one in which Jesus is sort of he goes and he's sacrificed against his will. And the father has to make some choice between saving his son and saving these people. You know what I'm talking about, right? And it's just bad. It's just a bad analogy. We don't want to create analogies that downplay what we know so clearly to be true about Jesus Christ. Our Savior willingly, Philippians 2, threw off his glory, threw off the fullness of his deity, right? That's heretical. My apologies. I didn't mean to say that. He empties himself, clearly, Philippians 2, right? And he comes down and he sheds his glory and he goes to the cross, right? All according to his will, which is 100% aligned with the Father's will. He's not an accidental victim. He is a willing Savior. And that should provide us great comfort. Abraham, verse 10, stretches out his hand, took the knife to slay his son. And what came into my mind, I actually wrote it in here. Right? We sing, it's the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, right? We sing, A Mighty Fortress is our God. And what came into my mind was the lyric that says, let goods and kindred go. Let goods and kindred go. Abraham is going to obey his God, the command of God, even if it costs him his son. And he's going to do it in faith. And we'll see that a little bit further. We'll bounce back into the New Testament. Verse 11, the angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. He said, do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him. For I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. So, what, I mean, did God learn something here? No. No, it's not as if God didn't know that Abraham was going to willingly go through with this. Of course not. God doesn't learn anything. God is the source of all knowledge. He doesn't learn things, right? This is here for us. This is here for us. You know, it's not as if when we stand before God on the last day and he says, well done, my good and faithful servant. Wasn't sure how that was going to turn out. No, of course not. God knows what we are going to do and say before we do it and say it. And yet he commends us for it. Right? And look at this commendation that Abraham receives, right? This is incredible for God to say something of this magnitude about a mere human being. It's incredible. Now I know that you fear God. Fear me. This is for us. And I decided that we're not going to get to it tonight. The plan for now, Lord willing, is that we're going to come back next week and not finish up Genesis 22 or jump into Genesis 23. But we will have a brief excursus on the doctrine of justification. Because back when we were in Genesis 15:6, we talked about Abraham believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. And we were in Romans chapter 4 at that time. And of course, we're going through Romans 4 in Sunday school. But this particular episode is also important to the doctrine of justification as we see in James chapter 2, which we didn't touch on at that time. So we'll come back next week and we'll build on the doctrine of justification. Again, 500th anniversary of Martin Luther's theses on the door at Wittenberg, so we might as well hover on the doctrine of justification a bit, right? So that, and this episode is front and center in the epistle of James. So, God doesn't learn anything, right? I turned, and again, echoes of the New Testament, right? Or as we're studying through Romans 8, which we're going to begin in Sunday school this coming Sunday. So when I hear this, let me just read Genesis 22:12, and then I'm going to immediately follow that with Romans 8:32. So Genesis 22:12, and he said, the angel of the Lord said, do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him, for I know now that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Romans chapter 8, verse 32. He, God, who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how will he not also with him freely give us all things? God calls, the angel of the Lord calls to Abraham and spares Abraham's son. He stays Abraham's hand. He does not do the same for his own son. He does not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all. Verse 13, Abraham raises his eyes. He looks, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. Two things here. Number one, Abraham had already said in verse 8 to his son Isaac, God will provide for himself the lamb. Prophecy, a manifestation of Abraham's faith, all of the above. Verse 13, God provides the offering. Providentially, graciously. And look at the end of verse 13. Do you see those words, those precious words? What precious words am I talking about there at the end of verse 13? Do you see how it says, in the place of? What's ringing in your ears when you read those? Huh? Yes. Substitution. God provides the sacrifice that Isaac could not provide. God provides a sacrifice in the place of Isaac. And these liberal commentators, these people today, they say they can't find substitutionary atonement in the Bible. To which I respond, maybe you should try reading your Bible with your eyes open. It's right there, verse 13. God provides a sacrifice in place of humans. So Abraham, verse 14, calls the name of that place, the Lord will provide. Right? Jehovah Jireh. As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it will be provided. And this is a precious name of God for us in the Bible, isn't it? This, the Lord will provide. Again, what's ringing in my ears, right, is the entirety of the New Testament, Philippians chapter 4. Paul found that he could be content in all things. Why? Because his God was Jehovah Jireh. He could be in plenty, he could be in want, it didn't matter. He was absolutely confident that God would provide for him what he needed, and therefore he was content. Matthew chapter 6. Why do you worry? Jesus says. Why do you worry? You worry about clothes and food and things Gentiles worry about. Don't you understand that God knows you need all of these things? None of us at this table has been called to out of the cloud by God and asked to offer up our son, our only son whom we love, as a sacrifice. And so in this, Abraham is our father. We are his seed. We are the nations who are blessed through Abraham and his seed. Ought we not have the faith of Abraham that is manifest in verse 8? God will provide. That's what Matthew 6, Philippians 4, that's what the New Testament, that's what we're trying to do. The New Testament writers are trying to get across to us. Even if he lets you be burned at the stake by Emperor Nero, he will provide for you up to your death, including courage and strength. And by the way, Jesus has already said to us in John, as we preach through John from the pulpit on Sunday morning, that he's gone ahead of us to prepare a place for us. So even when we die, he's already made provision for us when we arrive. God will provide, and so we should manifest the faith of Abraham and rest assured and confident and content in Jehovah Jireh. I'm not super spiritual, Steve. I wrestle with this the same as you. Same as you. But this is the message of the gospel. God will provide. He has provided. If you look back on your lives, you can look back and see with clarity, with 20/20 vision, that there has never been a day in your life when God did not provide for you exactly what you needed and more. And this is the prototype of that testimony. 15. The angel of the Lord calls to Abraham a second time from heaven. He says, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord. Right? This was back in Genesis 15. If you remember, Genesis 15, this was the covenant cutting ceremony where they took the animals. Abraham took the animals. He split them. God passes through in a flaming torch. By myself I have sworn. declares the Lord. Because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of the enemies. Verse 18, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Galatians chapter 3, verse 16. Now, some might read verses 16, 17, and 18 as there was some conditions placed on the promises made to Abraham, right? He says, because you have done this thing, and you have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you. It looks like a because, therefore. And here's the reality of the situation. First of all, God made a covenant, Genesis 15. He, in the form of a flaming torch, passed through the animals in a self-maledictory, covenant-cutting ceremony and oath to fulfill his promises to Abraham. Where was Abraham? Asleep. It is not as if this covenant depends on Abraham, because Abraham's obedience is wrought by the power of God. God tests, tries, proves Abraham, and God upholds Abraham. We have to have that in our minds. In the very same way, our obedience, we've talked about this over and over again, especially in Sunday schools, we're going through Romans. Our obedience is not wrought from somewhere deep inside of us. Our obedience finds its root in the grace and power of God. Okay? Galatians 3:16. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Paul looks at this text. And he only sees one person. Who is it? It's Jesus Christ. So, in all of this typology, all of these shadows, right, and mapping verse by verse this Genesis 22 into the New Testament, am I super spiritualizing the Old Testament? No. In fact, I'm just reading Paul in Galatians 3. That's it. And as we wrap up here, I want to commend to you, let's all turn to Hebrews 11, 17 through 19, just to prove to you again that I'm not super spiritualizing Genesis 22. Hebrews 11, 17 through 19. By faith, right? So Hebrews 11 is the hall of faith, right? It's going through the Old Testament, proving that it's really about faith. Faith, got it? Hebrews 11, right before James. Keep going, yep, right before, a couple pages back. Hebrews 11, 17 through 19. So Hebrews 11, hall of faith. This great cloud of witnesses, if we go to Hebrews 12, 1 and 2, this great cloud of witnesses, what's being referred to in Hebrews 12, 1 and 2, this great cloud of witnesses is back in Hebrews 11. The direct context of that is all of the saints from the Old Testament who believed God, and so it was credited to them as righteousness, as we see in Genesis 15, 6. That's the context. Hebrews 11, 17 through 19. The writer says this: by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he, Abraham, who had received the promises, was offering up his only begotten son. Verse 18. It was he, Abraham, to whom it was said, in Isaac your descendants shall be called or named. What's that a reference to? Genesis 21, 12. 19, he considered that God is able to raise men even from the dead, from which he, Abraham, also received him, Isaac, back as a type.
As a type of what? Huh?
Christ,
who was raised from the dead. Jesus, yes. Genesis 22:8, Abraham willingly offers up his son. He says, God will provide the sacrifice. This is, according to the writer of Hebrews, a manifestation of Abraham's faith, because he was willing to kill his son, believing, look, it's right there on the face of the text, verse 19, believing that even if God allowed him to kill his son, that God was so faithful and was so bent on keeping his promise that God would raise Isaac from the dead, just so through Isaac his descendants would be named. That's what it says. That is the faith we are called to have. Paul says, I died so many times. I should have been dead so many times. I should have been dead four times. Anybody? Anybody want to offer up the number for them? Four times I should be dead. Again, this typology that we have in Genesis 22, it's laid out for us right here in Hebrews 11. We know that Isaac is a type. We know that the offering of Isaac on Mount Moriah is a type, because God, through His Spirit, through the pen of whoever it was who wrote down this particular epistle to the Hebrews, tells us that it was a type. And it's there for us. It is a real historical event. It is a real historical event that God ordained sovereignly by His grace in the life of Abraham and Isaac. For what? 1 Corinthians 10, Paul says these things were written down for whom? You. They were written down for you. Why? So that you would be encouraged in your faith. So that, like Abraham, you would believe that even if this massive tragedy ends in death, that God will one day raise the dead, because He raised Jesus Christ, and because He's promised to raise us all at the end. That's the point. These are not just Sunday school stories for middle schoolers. These are biblical, redemptive, historical stories so that we might be encouraged. And we can see God's hand in the whole thing. And that we would be spurred on in our own faith.